Welcome to B&B Financially Free, the podcast for ambitious individuals chasing financial freedom through buying short-term rental investments. We're your hosts, Chantel and Peter, and we're the founders of Good Neighbor Realty. Our brokerage has helped hundreds of people turn their active income into passive income by buying unique properties in incredible locations that are earning a ton of money. On this show, we'll bring on a diverse range of guests, from industry experts to everyday people who have achieved extraordinary results in their short-term rental investments, businesses, and personal lives. Whether you're seeking tactical advice or trying to unlock your richest life, B&B Financially Free is here to join you on the journey. All right. And I could not be more excited to have Travis in the house today. Travis, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know Travis, Travis is a good friend of mine, a former client, a hard
money... What's a client? Always a client.
Yeah. A hard money lender, a real estate investor. How many homes do you own now?
13 in the Denver area.
13. Damn. Why don't you start off by just like telling us how you got into real estate investing?
For sure. Yeah. So, and it was a journey before we met, right? Mm-hmm. And so we'll get into that a little bit too. So I started in 2009. I did my first fix and flip with my dad. And obviously the time was a little different then, right?
He was a contractor, right?
That's right. Contractor by trade. And we'd done a couple of deals. Mostly it was his deals, but I'd show up or work or whatever. And it was the first time that we were going to take like a run at it in as a business and not as a hobby. And so we hired all of the work out, went through a local mentor here's program for the mentorship piece. The house was right on my way to my W-2 job at the time. And so I was able to check in on it frequently.
What did you used to do?
Good question. So right out of college, I worked at a company called Ferguson. Most people would know them for plumbing fixtures. I worked on the industrial side of it, and not because I knew anything about it or was an engineer. It's just a seat that I got. So I was selling pipe valves and fittings to oil and gas, power plants. I used to go to the Xcel energy plants around town and like refill their little bins with parts and things like that.
Could see you being good at that.
Yeah, right. It was fun because the projects you worked on were generally big and kind of important, right? Versus like somebody needing a toilet, right? I mean, I guess those are important too, but it was just a little bit different side of the business and it was exciting and it was always big projects. So I did that first flip with him and that was in 2009. And sometime later that year, I'd actually met a gentleman at a local hard money lending company here. He was looking to hire somebody because he had just raised, at that time, $3 million, which would seem like a lot back then. But keep in mind, the loans or the houses were $60,000, the rehabs were $30,000, and the ARVs were $120,000 to $150,000.
So your first flip, do you remember how much the purchase price was?
Oh, I think it was like $62,000 or $65,000. We probably put like $28,000 into it and then sold it on the back end at like $140,000 or something like that.
Why are you so cheap now?
That's right. That's exactly right. Although I'm still so used to those numbers that I can't do with the numbers that we have in the market today. And so we did well on it. We made some money and then we were going to go do another one. And so I got another property under contract. It was in North Aurora and the numbers didn't quite work for a flip. That's when I was introduced to the BRRRR strategy, you know, the buy, whatever it is, rehab, rent, refinance. And I was doing that with hard money and we were buying houses. When I say we, my then girlfriend, now wife, Natalie. And so we were buying these houses with $3,000, $5,000, $6,000 out of pocket. And we were buying, I guess, as quickly as we were able. But of course, when you look back, you think you wish you would have done more. So we were buying houses, did some in Aurora, some in Mont Bello, some Southwest Denver, eventually to Green Valley Ranch. And so we were buying, fixing, and refinancing, and at this time with little or no money in. And what's crazy back then was you could buy a house for $60,000 or $70,000, put $20,000 or $30,000 into it, get that after repaired appraisal, and literally have less than $5,000 into it. And at that time, they still cash flowed. Your payment was $600 a month. Your rent at that time in Mont Bello for a 4-bedroom, $1,250 a month. So like you were making money on day one. Very different than the environment we're in today. So did that pretty heavy up until about 2013. And then I thought, man, I want to learn how to do new construction. Reached out to one of our clients at the time who was doing some new construction. And I thought I wanted to build a duplex, actually not far from where we're sitting here in Sloan's Lake. And at that time, everybody was kind of getting the itch for a duplex. So it was hard to find a duplex lot. So we ended up finding a 7-unit at 18th and Irving, so not far from here. So I bought that in 13, built it, delivered it in 15. I'm still doing hard money loans this whole time. The building was a little more passive. And then every time we'd come out of those one of those projects, we'd buy one or two more rental properties.
And so you sold the entire development?
Everything was for sale townhomes. You know, at that time, it seemed like, wow, if somebody would pay us this money, we should sell it. Again, hindsight always being 20/20, like, wow, if we'd have held these for 4 or 5 years, what would that have looked like? But of course, we used that equity to keep doing it. So then I built 8 townhomes, actually really close to here at 12th and Utica, and 2 4-unit buildings. Did really well on that one. Took that money, so that was in 2017, bought a lot right next to Mile High Stadium in Jefferson Park. And if you're in Denver, you've seen it. They're white townhomes with black pitched roofs that are right on the highway. That one was a little more challenging. Went about $500,000 over budget. We enter COVID. I end up leasing it and selling it to an out-of-state 1031 buyer. But it was.
Were you planning on leasing it? Because that's kind of scary because you're committing to a year-long lease.
So in 2019, the fall of 2019, we're trying to pre-sell these things. Rates are inching up, still lower than they are today, but they were inching up and the market was slowing down a little bit. But the cap rates were on new multifamily were still like 4%. So I started leasing them or planning to in November. And then in March of that year, COVID hits. And so we leased right through COVID, no problem. We didn't have any problems with construction due to COVID, like a lot of people had with appliances or materials, because we were pretty much there. So as we're getting our certificates of occupancy, we're leasing these things up with the intent to sell it though, because at that point, being so far over budget, I have so much money into it, not including the equity I had for the bank loan. And so like, I've got like a ton of money in this and I've got a newborn at home. I'm like literally up in the middle of the night, like trying to figure out how much money I'm willing to lose on this to get rid of it. It was stressful. What ended up working and the company and guy who helped me through this as a mentor, and they did everything they said they would and were fantastic, helped me through the lease and the sale and the whole thing. Because we leased these things up and I was still on my construction loan payment was like $20,000 a month, but I'm collecting $36,000 a month in rent, right? Of course, it's on an interest-only loan. So 12 units of right around $3,000 a piece. So we get them leased up, it's all good, but then we go on the market to sell it. And this is right kind of when rates are dropping and it feels like buyers are looking for blood in the water. But you know, I had some time to hold it because I was still making money. I end up selling it in December of 2020. So I get my last payout in January from the rentals and I made about $100,000 on the deal, but after about 2.5 years with like what felt like every dollar I had into it. So after that, I come out, I've got a bunch of cash on hand. I start paying off some rental properties because I thought I don't ever want to be in that position again. And then I guess from there, you know, we'd still been buying and kept rentals. We're a net buyer. I've only sold rental properties I bought as a rental to do an exchange to buy more. And so then I guess fast forward just a touch from there, we start talking in early 2021, right? I'm sitting on a fair amount of cash. I'm looking for a place to invest it to create more cash flow. And as we just talked about, I had been buying properties for 60, 70, 80, 90,000, even out in First Creek and Green Valley Ranch, it was in a construction defect lawsuit. I bought 4 units at that time and we were buying them for like 160, right? And so, and this was not that long before we meet and I'm like, all right, I'm looking for rental properties, but I can't find anything that makes sense, right? Of course, I'm used to cash flowing $600, $800 right out of the purchase. And I talked to you and I'm like, hey, I'm interested in this Airbnb thing. But what did I tell you day one? Like, just going to be super clear. Like if the cleaners don't show up, the next people will check into a dirty unit.
I'm not doing anything. I'm not going over there with toilet paper. Yep.
Right. And so you and I, we go out on the hunt, right? And we find that first one on Charles in Sherwood. It was a flip property that had been on the market for a little bit, still needed a little bit of work, right? So we buy that. We'd spend our weekends over there, you know, putting furniture together, my wife and I. And I had this grand scheme where like I would find it, I would do the construction, and then my wife would manage it on the back end. And she learned that that's how we were going to do it by listening to a podcast that I was on at about that time. And so she was, oh, so this is the route we're going. Yeah, it seems reasonable, yeah, right?
No big deal.
Yeah, no big deal. 3 young kids at home. One of them at that point is, I guess Annabelle at that point was almost 1.5 years.
She's a business owner.
Yeah. My wife's a business owner. She had 3 salons at the time and was like really busy. So I don't know why that didn't work well. So of course, in my world, is if it works once, you should do it a bunch of times, right? So what are we, 6 weeks later, we're under contract.
Like, let's just buy something else.
Yeah, we're still looking. We buy the house over on Marigold, so just a block away. And we do all the same thing. We get it up and going. We made good money that summer. This is the summer of 21. A lot of people are still traveling. We are collecting in some months $8,000-$10,000 a month gross, right? Each property, and we're killing it. I think that in hindsight, there were some mistakes that we made because I wanted the highest cash flow. We looked for 4-bedroom houses, right? And they were always full Thursday to Sunday, and you knew it when they left because they were usually pretty rough on the property. But we were making good money. Enter that fall, where I think historically Colorado would have saw a big convention type of visitors. COVID's kind of ramping back up. Everything's getting canceled again, and it's starting to get slow. On one of the properties, we actually had somebody reach out as a nonprofit for, at that time, we were accepting, I think, Afghan refugees.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And so this nonprofit hits me, and they're like, hey, we need this thing for like a month. And I'm like, oh, well, surely I would give them a deal, right? Like, I mean, this is like a pretty crazy scenario. And they just pay full freight for like a month. So I'm like, oh, wow, I'm still cashing checks on this thing. Fast forward a little bit further, we get closer to November, to Thanksgiving, where again, you would expect to get some bookings, but kind of slow time of year. And I think at that point we were, I don't want to say burned out on it, but and to be totally fair, we sold the properties. That's how the story ends. But it was kind of so easy there for a bit that you didn't have to have great systems. You know, people would ask you questions, you'd answer. Like, it was relatively, I don't want to say passive, but it was easy, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like a long-term rental where the person calls you on Thanksgiving to tell you the furnace is out. Oh, and it's been out for 2 weeks, right? Those things are challenging. But in these scenarios, it's like, hey, where's the iron, right? Or where should we go to dinner? And it's like, well, God invented Google, so check it out.
My favorite texts from you were like, why do people not know how to Google? Like, what do you want me to tell them? Like, Waterworld's down the street.
Yeah.
Like,
what more do you need? Yeah. And so it was like, it was the money was easy. We got into a slower time of year. And again, 3 young kids at home. Like, I don't know if I have toilet paper at home, let alone at this Airbnb. And so I think if we would have really hunkered down and like put the right systems and processes in place, or even maybe even shifted to management, we could have continued to own them. But I actually always felt a little bad because it's this quiet neighborhood. This house is getting 8 people, you know, on it for the weekend. The neighbor's got like his veteran flag out. Like, what are they thinking is going on here? You know?
You had a lot of shame around that.
I would show up and like duck my head, you know, like I didn't want to talk to the neighbors. I didn't want them. Like, there could have been a different process of like, hey, this is what we're doing here. I just wanted to like be in and out. And so we end up selling both of those properties. I think both of them maybe closed in December of 21. One of them, I met a gal at a conference who bought it. Both buyers wanted to operate them as Airbnbs. And much like your business now that you're seeing, as people are exiting, you're finding other people who want to operate or are already operators who are better. And now they're buying maybe more units. The second house that we sold, and I told you I'd say this, you made more money on it than I did, right?
I did. I got the buy and the sell.
And so I think both of them are still operating as Airbnbs. I think one of the individuals was like a little more focused on like really making this their business. And it's not to say that it doesn't work. It just wasn't for me, right? At that time, I'd already had the 13 rentals, like the monthly cash flow we're making, the money that we're making from my loan business and also from my wife's business. Like, I mean, I don't want to sound arrogant, but like it didn't move the needle for us, right? And so it just wasn't worth that extra push when we're going to soccer and gymnastics and dance. And so
It's so funny for me to hear that because I don't have any background in long-term rental investing. Like, my only experience in long-term rentals is actually what got me into short-term rentals because I basically became a slumlord for properties in Georgia that I bought as wholesales, and like it was the worst. And so my experience was like exactly the opposite, where I like inherited these properties with all of these problems. My tenants like were having a hard time paying rent. It made me sad every single month. Like, I didn't want to ask them. Right. Like, life is hard already and I'm having to like chase them down for rent, and like the property sucks. And so I ended up losing money on those, like getting out of those like long-term rentals. And then that led me into short-term rental, where I'm like, this is the dream. I get paid at check-in. The house is perfectly maintained. I don't have to commit to someone for like 12 months. But you, on the other hand, starting as like a long-term rental investor, you're like, I do not want to tell you where to get a beer tonight.
100%.
I don't have time for it. And like the money, like, and I think that that's something for people to consider is like, if you're making a lot of money in your like W-2 or your other investments, it's not going to, it could be life changing for some, but it might not be worth it for others who just want to be like completely hands off don't want to think about it. So from like an active versus like passive income standpoint, for those who might have like a long-term rental background, what do you think are like the major differences between operating a long-term rental as a landlord versus a short-term rental?
Yeah, the number one way to say it for me is that you're entering the hospitality business, right? And I'm sure that, and I know in a lot of the things that you communicate that that's what it is that you go from, hey, my washer's not working, to, cool, we'll send a repair guy, he might be there next week, to, hey, the washer's not working, can somebody come over here and fix it right now, because they think they're at the Four Seasons. Now, don't get me wrong, like in some of the ways we present these properties, you try to make them like gigabyte internet, washer and dryer in unit. And like, it's not really for you, it's for the cleaners, right? It's actually just kind of for looks. I didn't think you'd do laundry while you were here, you know? And so it's hard to hit those like quick responses of like needing something. I remember I accidentally put in the listing that it had an iron and an ironing board. And this guy, he must've been going to the club, right? Cause he's like, yo, I'm trying to get fit up here and can't find the iron. I'm like, there's no damn iron in that house, you know?
You're ruining his entire night. Like, maybe he shows up weekend to the club. Yeah.
Wrinkled, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm on Target using the Shipt at the time. And 30 minutes later, there's an iron at the front door and an ironing board, right? And it's just these things that you're not used to doing. And I think that my tenants would describe me, and I don't manage my properties anymore, but I did. Like, I was always on it because it's just like, kind of to the reverse is like, hey, these people live here. They're paying a good chunk of their monthly income to live in this property. If the furnace is out or there's rodents or whatever, like, let's get this taken care of. I want you to be happy. I want you to stay. It was almost the reverse in the Airbnb because it's like, dude, you're going to be here for 12 more hours. Like, you can't like find a roll of paper towels, you know? And so I think that we just found like pretty quickly that people are in the hospitality side, they're not as self-sufficient. And I guess rightfully so. If I'm going out with my family and staying at a hotel and the bed, there's something wrong with the bed or it's loud or the HVAC isn't working, like I kind of want that fixed, right? And so I think it was a different realization of not even necessarily like on call, because there's all these systems you can build around it, right? You only get 6 different questions. And as long as you have an auto response for that, I think the tools are better now too, just a couple
they
of
are.
Years later.
Yeah, actually.
Yeah. I mean, whether you had a problem with the door code not working or this or that or noise, like I've never had to tell one of my long-term tenants that they were too loud, right? The
right.
police will handle that.
Right.
But at an Airbnb, you're like, oh gosh, you don't want the neighbors to rat you out or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the biggest difference is that you're now in the hospitality business. And if you don't have, maybe I wouldn't even say a soft spot, but if you're not like ready to make people happy for these, what in some cases would feel like big payouts, then it's probably not for you.
I could not agree more with that. And I don't think I realized that until recently, especially because honestly, like people expect even more now than when you were in the space, because the whole industry has matured as a whole. And so they're expecting like quick responses, because now you're competing with institutional and like sophisticated investors who have come into this space. And guess what? It is like the Four Seasons.
Yeah.
And so now like people are competing like at hotel level service, and now the customer has come to expect it. And if you're someone who wants to be offline and like not available, like it could be stressful for you to miss a message about an iron, or God forbid someone finds a mouse. And you're right, everything has to be done really quickly.
Right.
Like your response time, it doesn't work for you to say they'll be there tomorrow or next week, because maybe they're only there for 2 days and then their entire vacation is ruined.
Like I'm still in some of these Airbnb groups on Facebook, and I sometimes just laugh to myself because somebody's like, oh my gosh, like X, Y, and Z happen. What if I get a bad review? And I just kind of laugh a little bit, because it's like I got into it too. And your clients got into this Airbnb business because it's lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody got into it so that they could be tied to their phone to respond to where the best Chinese restaurant is, right? And so people are like slave to this review. What if I get a bad review? And it's like,
like, you've got to figure that out. Like, this is now your business, mm-hmm. right? I've never had a bad review from a long-term tenant.
It's so true. You know? It's so true. And I've seen, like, there is a temperament type that really struggles in short-term rental. And I will say it's, like, that Facebook group Nancy.
For
who's
sure.
always posting about, like, oh, God, like, you know, they're upset because they found a hair in the sheet. And it's, like, you do have to be a business owner mm-hmm. where you have some level of thick skin.
For sure.
Like, not everybody is going to be happy, even in like the nicest places. Like, you're going to get like bad feedback, bad reviews, but it's like, how do you deal with that? Like, can you resolve it by like adding some, like paying some compensation to the guests and just chalk it up to like, this is the cost of business? Or are you going to let it ruin like your entire day
or longer
yeah. because like you couldn't, I had someone literally yesterday, and you'll never hear me like as like a person that talks about this kind of stuff with my friends, because it's literally not worth my energy trying to talk about it. But like, she's sending me photos of under my sink and like under the beds. And I'm like, girl, this is on you. You know, if you want to like spend your vacation, like getting under my sink, like good on you. Yeah. Like, here's some money back. Sure. Like, on your way.
I wonder if there's even a little culture around that though, where it's like, okay, this place is $800 a night. How can we retrade this later? And if knowing what you and I know on the operator side, as a guest, you could just extort people, right? Like, hey, I promise to give you a 5-star, but I need $500 back for whatever happened here. And
right.
I have to guess that 8 out of 10 people would whine about it, but they'd probably do it because they're so worried about that bad review.
Yeah. And that's like going back to like, you are in the hospitality business. For me, as someone who manages my own rentals, and like we can talk through, I have like extra help on like certain things, but I just chalk it up to like cost of business. I'm like, I'm saving 20% single month by managing my own short-term rental. If I have someone who like is just gonna threaten me with a bad review, I'm just gonna give it to them. I'm not even gonna think about it. Like, right. I have a budget in mind every single month for a like Karen budget. Mm-hmm. Like, no offense to the Karens, because I've had some nice ones, but like, I have that set aside. I don't think about it. I don't talk to my friends about it. I don't post on Facebook about it. It literally does not matter to me.
Yeah. And I think that there's a business operator mentality, as you said, but what that conflicts with is the numbers that somebody, oh, this one's going to do $100,000 this year. It might take you a year to get set up before you hit $100,000 a year, mm-hmm. whatever it is. And mm-hmm. like, you're going to have to take your lumps along the way. And if they're really mad they didn't have a crock pot, like, you might just buy a crock pot, right? Mm-hmm. And then you'll never have that complaint again. But it's curious though, how difficult that is on the hospitality side and how much different it is from a more passive investment. Now, in the interest rate environment that we're in today, in second quarter of 2024, I'm curious, maybe even to hear from you, like, is this still working? Because it felt like for a bit there, somebody could stretch on purchase or stretch on a property or buy more properties than maybe they could have otherwise because the carry was so low, like the cash flow was there. But those same houses now are actually selling for more, and at, gosh, as we sit here today, it might be a 7.5% rate. So how does that work in?
Yeah, I mean, everything has to be done really right. Mm-hmm. So like when you and I were working together, I was like, it doesn't matter. Like, just like get some decent furniture, get professional photos. You're going to be so far ahead of everybody else in mm-hmm. the space. Today, it's completely different.
Yeah.
It's like the house needs to be special. The location needs to make sense. The design, like you have to hit it on like every single aspect of short-term rental. And if you do that, you are playing in like the top properties in your particular market. But what I'm seeing is like, if you're not performing like the top properties are, or like as a very budget-friendly stay, so that's like maybe your property, but you accommodate a 4-bedroom, you accommodate 12 people. Like it's really affordable for like a group of 12 people to stay. Or you're someone who has a really nice property with all of the amenities. You have the game rooms, you have the artificial turf, you have the murals. Like those two sectors are doing really well, like the luxury or like hugely amenitized themes or your super budget stays. The people that are hurting is everybody in the middle.
That feels like a lot though.
It's
like maybe
a lot.
60% or more is in the middle.
Yeah. There's a lot of people that are hurting now just because, you know, they bought at a time where you didn't really have to try that hard.
Sure.
And now the design is like not competing. And so what I'm seeing a lot happen is people that are committed to their short-term rental business are reinvesting in higher level of design. And I think that someone like you would be like, I am not redesigning this property for
40. I don't have this in my house.
Like, I'm not doing this. I'm not going to put like another 20, 30, 40K. But I kind of think that it ends up being similar to what you could experience in long-term rental. You have a tenant who trashes your home.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to have to go in there and rehab it before you flip it to another one. And so I think that like real estate investing, like at some level, like you are reinvesting into these assets no matter what you choose.
Sure. And I think that's another piece that might be lost in the difference between the two is your furniture will get destroyed over time. Your rugs will get stained. Your spatulas will go missing. Your dishware will break or whatever. And that you have to have money set aside to continue to improve it too. And it's not a set it and forget it, right? I mean, you have to budget for these things. But as people, I think you get tied to, oh, I made $8,000 last month. But did you, you know, and then what does next month look like? And then what is the where's your replacement fund or whatever, so that you have money to buy that couch and that couch might have to be delivered between a checkout and check in on a Thursday afternoon, right? In order for it to work, or you're using a service or something like that to make sure you can hit that box. And so definitely more hands-on, but in the environment that we're in today, I can see why people do it. I mean, I could see why Garrett continues to do it. I can see why somebody would want to do the house hack with not the long-term on one side, but a short-term or medium-term on one side, where they can juice just a little bit more money out of it and get more rent or more income because it's so close to them, right? And when it's your own home, I think you have a tendency to check on it more, of course, and to maybe be a little bit more responsive. But I also think you're going to you're not going to live in a one bedroom with a four bedroom next door and have parties every weekend, right? It could be the reverse, where you're going to probably promote like a more quiet stay with a one or two bedroom or something like that. And I mean, even working on a project now in Inglewood, a new construction project, we're really early on it, but we're trying to figure out in our early layouts, how do you create that lock off? I mean, it's a stone's throw from the hospital. And so if you could create an efficiency or a space for a traveling nurse that would, you know, I don't know what, that maybe it's $1,200, $1,500, $2,000 a month for this person, and it's connected to this other unit. The price point of the units are, say, they're $750-ish, still in a price point where it makes sense that someone would want to generate some extra income. But I work with some other developers where we recently and continue to have the conversation of, where's that breaking point? Because I think at about $700,000, $800,000, maybe even $1,000,000, there's still somebody out there. It's a little entrepreneurial. It's like, yeah, I'll rent my ADU or I'll do the lock off in the basement. But once you get to like $1,500,000, like, doesn't that person just want to have their house? Like, that buyer's pool that's going to actually use that extra space is so much smaller. Now, it could also work for a college age student, an au pair, nanny, or something like that, but it just starts to shrink. So in the right price point, we're still trying to find a way to deliver a product that someone could Airbnb midterm rent or whatever it is. So
I think I think that that's super thoughtful for, you know, people that are developing or selling a property, like in today's interest rate environment, to have a lock off unit at the right price point. And I agree with you. I think the breaking point is probably 1.2 and under. You still have people at that like 1.2 range who want to have like some offset in their mortgage, but at some level, people just don't want to see anybody at their home. But on like, you know, what's working today, I will say like there are quite a few people who are making significant cash flow still today on short-term rental, but I don't know what the alternative is. Like what works today, you know, like it's really, really hard to make the numbers work on multifamily. Sure. Like I think, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this, but like if you're a buy and hold investor, and that's like where I think you've grown most of your wealth
for is sure.
Just like buying real estate, holding it over time. Me too. Long-term rental doesn't work.
It doesn't. I mean, you're looking at, let's say the median price is $600,000 in this market, and an investor loan, you're minimum 15% down, but let's say you're 20% down. So you're $120,000 day one. And that payment with that money down, like super rough numbers, call it $3,500 or $4,000 a month, taxes and insurance included. You can't go get that in rent in Denver for $600,000. I mean,
in most metropolitans, you can't get it right now.
Run of the mill neighborhood where your rents are probably $2,800 to maybe $3,200 a month. So not only did you put a big chunk down, you're losing $600 to $800 a month in the difference before considering management and repairs. So you got to make a decision.
can you squeeze more money out of the property by going short term, medium term, or something along those lines?
Or like room by room rental.
Yeah, for sure. And that to me is just a whole nother game of managing. I know there's some people that do it really well in town, but gosh, I mean, I couldn't even take care of a house, let alone like this guy's eating this other guy's pizza. You know, I don't, what do you do about that? So I don't see it working, but what I do think, and I'd be really curious if there was a way to extract this data maybe longer term, is like people have been buying and holding real estate for a long time, and you always make your wealth from the upside. The monthly, like if you cash flow, great, right? Principal pay down, time of ownership. I'm actually helping my dad right now take a rental property that was performing fine. We just did a light rehab on it. We're going to sell it, use that money and park it into a fund that pays, a fixed rate, because the money, the actual cash flow in pocket would be better. He's owned this property for about 14 years. And I was just doing the math this morning. The multiple was, it's worth about 5 times more than what he paid for it. He collected some cash flow along the way, got some tax benefits, probably rehabbed it twice. But he'll make more money not being in a rental property. I don't know that that was always true, because the leverage returns were so high, mm-hmm. high teens, low 20s. And so to answer the question, I think if you bet on Denver long-term for what it is versus going to Kansas City for cash flow or Arkansas mm-hmm. or something like that, you're going to get the appreciation long-term, but you're going to have to feed it. And I just don't know how attractive it is for, even if you're a high income earner, to part with $100,000 plus lose money every month to own a rental property. Mm-hmm. Now, alternatively, if you were a move up buyer and you had a good rate, you might keep your old property if you had a low basis. But of course, then you'd have to have the money in hand, either take a loan or have the money in hand to buy your next property. So I think owning real estate long-term is still good, but I do think we're in this window right now where people aren't going to be acquiring. I mean, I did an exchange last year. I sold a little house in North Aurora, bought a house in Westminster, just a little better asset. I don't make money on that. And I was making money on my last property, but long-term got it a little bit of a discount, and it's just a better asset to own. And so I'm happy to own it. But so difficult to jump in at those numbers. I mean, if you wanted to buy a house a year, every other year, like that's a lot of money to be saving mm-hmm. regardless of what your income is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know a lot of, and actually I really want to get into this with you, is people are interested in Airbnb.
Mm-hmm.
And you get that.
For sure.
Because you're a hard money lender. So let's talk about like people who are considering doing that. Like, for someone who wants to buy a property that is distressed,
mm-hmm.
they want to fix it up, they want to refinance and pull out their money, what do you think you could expect today? Like, how do you finance that type of deal? Is it reasonable to be able to expect that you will be able to get your money out in today's like environment? Let's talk about Colorado.
Sure. So 15 years ago, we would teach the class of investing with no money down, right? Use the true burr when you could burr. Now I think the conversation would be little or less money down, right? By the time you do the refinance and the whole thing. What I think, and I don't want to generalize too much, is that for the person who wants to burr B&B, which sounds beautiful. I mean, it sounds like a great model.
So
right?
cool.
Yeah, right? Very catchy. Is that the typical Airbnb investor or operator is not a real estate investor from the way of buy, fix, flip, or buy, renovate, right? And to go even further, you have clients and mutual friends that have bought houses at market value and have put another $100,000 into it to create that experience.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way you're going to capture that back out, because although you're improving maybe the marketability or the ability to cash flow from an Airbnb perspective, you've not actually add any value to the home for a resale value.
Well, I'm going to stop you there.
Okay.
So there's this crazy niche market where, let's say that like you as an investor, you don't want to deal with setting up the Airbnb. You know that that's miserable. It's a ton of cash out of pocket. People right now are purchasing existing short-term rentals with revenue history, with furnishing at a premium. The thing that is difficult is it has to appraise residentially. And so I would say that like if you're a prudent investor who is going to put $100,000 into a property that's like turnkey, you can make a lot of money on that. I have people that are netting $60,000 every single year after doing that. You do need to be careful that like you are within the range that an appraiser can justify.
Sure,
because
sure.
if you're buying a $500,000 property, you're putting $100,000 into it, it's going to be a great cash flow asset. But guess what? If you will not be able to get that property appraised for $700K.
Right.
And so I think that that's really important. Like, we have friends that, you know, have bought in areas where there are homes that are selling for like far more than what they purchased. Yep. And usually I can get an appraiser on board if there are comps. If there are not comps, you need to be really careful about investing.
I think to make that work best, going back to your point of distressed or hoarder house, whatever, like the traditional fix and flip house.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to run your numbers in the BRRRR scenario. And this is how I do it even when I was BRRRRing for long-term rental was I could pay a little more than the flipper could because I don't need a margin at the end of this, but I need to be able to get as much of my money out as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously your holding costs could be shorter and you don't have agent fees on the back end. So you could go a little higher in price, but to the same thing today, you would effectively want to buy it at flip numbers, make those improvements. Along your improvements, you would do some of these things like the wallpaper, the accent walls, and these other things. Challenging to finance in your construction or bridge loan any amount of furniture, but there's ways you could work a budget if the numbers worked to make all of that work. So you would do the same, buy, fix, furnish, and then Airbnb it, right? And a refinance somewhere in the middle. I think your expectation should be that you're going to have some money into it. Maybe that's 10% as an example. Well, on a $500,000 purchase, 600 in construction, 600, if you could buy a house that was ready to go with 60 grand in after your refinance, like that'd be a win, right? I think it'd still be a win closer to 180 or 100,000 into it if you were going to produce those numbers of 60,000 a year because your payback period would be relatively quick and you wouldn't be losing money. You would have startup costs. So, you know, assuming a cash on cash return and not a return of investment, I think you would get there, but you'd have to approach it on the front end as a fix and flip. The piece coming back previously where I don't think most Airbnb operators are like in that fix and flip space is like a lot of my clients are doing 2-3 fix and flips a month. Like how do you compete with their ability to find deals, their ability to do construction at the right price and to deliver? It can be done, but it's challenging. I think that if somebody...
I mean, you and I are dealing with that right now.
Exactly.
So like I've been out looking for flips to Airbnb, but it's crazy because like I lost to someone who was willing to pay way higher than me because they were a hedge fund. And by the time it's on the market, like you're at like such a disadvantage.
Sure.
The guy did like 100K of hard earnest money. And I'm like, I just can't do that because if you and I need an extra day to close, they're going to be like, we'll take your 100K of earnest money,
kind of money
and then I'm going to sell it back to other guy.
For sure.
So like if you're going to be competing, and I will say, I think that like everything is possible. And like for me, you know, I run a brokerage. I run an Airbnb business. This isn't my whole, like, this is a hobby
for
me. Like, I'm not running a wholesale or flip company and I am competing with people who are doing this full time. They're doing the mailers. They're doing the cold calls. And so I think that people need to be aware of if you're looking for something with like meat on the bones, like, it is possible, but it can take a really long time if this is not your full-time thing.
Yeah, and if you're looking for that absolute home run, like you may never get it. But if you're willing to go out and get a base hit and find a house in North Glen or something where it has a rear entrance and you can split it into two units relatively easy and go Airbnb and or midterm rental, like I think you could do that. Like probably like pretty easily.
Yeah.
Even if it was a thin wholesale deal or if it was an on-market deal that somebody could help you, it'd be a little slower transaction, you could run your numbers and all that. I think that's certainly possible. But the expectation of low or no money in via BRRRR, Airbnb, I am not a naysayer. Anything is possible, but it will be very difficult. And if you need low to no money down to make it work, I don't know if it's the best strategy.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, even when I was looking personally, I was considering it a win to have 10% like left in the deal. So for those of you who are new to this, like if you're thinking like maybe I'll buy a property, undervalue, I'll put some work into it and then I'll refinance and get all of my money out. A big challenge is that banks typically will only give you 80%
for sure
of the value when you refinance. And so you're having to get it at a really, really good deal.
Yeah,
and increase the value quite a bit to be able to get out all of your money. And so I'm with you. I agree that like everything is possible, but probably a more realistic expectation is to have, you know, 10% into the deal, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less, but you have to be really, really careful
with that. Agreed. And I think that probably for somebody who wanted to have less in And I don't know if you've covered this at length on an episode, is where you were doing the wrap or the subject to financing, where somebody might have a great rate. If you've got some money to put down, mm-hmm. it seems like a great way to be able to operate relatively quickly to cash flow. Maybe there's a small window of a balloon where you could refinance that later and get some money out. But that to me is interesting. And just with your knowledge and database of people who are operating what we'll call in that 60% that we talked about previously in the middle, where it's like, gosh, I don't know, Chantal, this is okay when it's good, but it's pretty bad when it's bad. They could exit that, or they could go to long-term rental. I think the hesitation, it was mine too, to take those properties I'd bought as short-term rentals to transition to long-term was like, I got a whole house full of furniture here, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and yeah. Some of it, like, I mean, I guess I paid full price on this Amazon list of all the stuff you told me to buy. Like, what am I going to do with all of this? Like, it was just so much easier of a sale to find somebody who would understand. And we didn't sell, I suppose it was at a small premium, but it's ready to go.
Yeah. Here's the thing. You don't buy a property and then sell it for a profit like 6 months later. Right. Not that you got like profit, but like the fact that you can get in and get out of a short-term rental without losing a lot of money, like in that quick amount of time, I think just goes to show that like, if you are a short-term rental operator and you have something with like strong revenue potential, there are buyers out there that would pay a premium for the work that you did, but like your buyer pool is very, very niche. And that's been actually cool for our brokerage, is we have been like working with people who have put a lot of time and effort into the short-term rental. Maybe they're, you know, tired, they don't have enough time to actually deal with like asking where to go for Chinese food that night, like, and they're ready to get out. We have been able to find a lot of buyers who are like, I'm out of state, I don't want to set this up, but like, I'm a great operator. Like, I'm really great from the system standpoint. And so it's cool that you can actually increase the asset value there.
I also think like, even for my kids, like now, even today, 3 years later, if we're like, hey, we're out and about, we're going to go to a house today. And if, and hey, maybe it's one that we own. They still say, is it the one on Charles Way? Like, because they remember sitting in front of Netflix while I'm putting like bed frames together, right? And there were some things where I think a lot of times in investing specifically that it's a shiny object syndrome, right? At that time for me, it was like, oh, this is cool. Oh, all we have to do is go over there this weekend and put this stuff together. Like, it feels like so much less work than it actually is. But for the person who's just getting in and has the time and energy and maybe not a family to actually go and do the work, like, what a great way to take an otherwise not profitable or not great return rental property and make it that way, mm-hmm. and to force those returns through Airbnb or short-term rentals. Beautiful model. But there's that sweat equity, right? And that's a piece that, I mean, you may not be swinging a hammer, but you might be hanging, you know, things on the walls or managing a contractor to make a lock off or installing these different cameras and making sure the internet's working. Like, there's a lot of little funky intricacies that you may not realize. I think we get so fixated on what the return's going to be that we don't maybe miss that window from purchase to when that return mm-hmm. starts happening.
Absolutely. And then on the other side of it, like if you, so the, another thing that's happened since you've purchased is all of these businesses to help with all of these pain points now exist. Sure. And they really didn't at the time. And so like now there are companies that will do the install. There are designers that specialize in short-term rentals. There are people who do revenue management. There are VA systems that can like talk with your guests. And so now there's all of these solutions, but it comes at a premium.
For sure.
And so like, if you want to use a designer that does install, so what I would sell you today, let's talk about that. Right. Here's what I would sell you today. So like, you need a, like a lifestyle investment mm-hmm. because like the cash flow, as much as it's great, like it's probably not going to do it for you. So something that like is a legacy property that you're going to leave Charlie one day, like Charlie, right? Charlie. Yeah. And so you would have something that's like near a ski resort or in the mountains that like you would really enjoy. You're going to get a property manager. You're going to make close to $0 every single month on that property with a property manager, but you're never going to answer a question about where to go out to eat. Mm-hmm. The tax benefits for someone who's not a real estate professional are really, really huge. That's why a lot of people are buying them still, is because if you're not a real estate professional, short-term rental offers amazing tax benefits. You can do a cost segregation study. And basically the only rule that you need, along with a few others, is this: the minimum night stays need to be 7 days or less.
Oh, okay.
So because of that, you can actually qualify to do bonus depreciation. So if you have a high W-2, you're not a real estate professional, you can really reduce your tax liability through short-term rental. You can have a place that you and your family love that they can enjoy like long-term. That type of investment makes sense for someone who's like, I don't need the cash flow, but I know that like Vail is going to increase in value every single year. I can get a property manager involved. I'm not making any cash flow, but the taxes and the legacy and the appreciation are what I'm in it for.
Yeah. And I think that even if you don't go cost seg in that situation, you go buy a $1 million property, just the depreciation through the standard depreciation schedule is significant. I mean, when I look at a property I'm going to do a 1031 exchange on today, I had this huge upside because I bought it for $60,000, right? And I was selling it for $400,000 or $500,000. But when I look at what I'm depreciating against my original purchase price, which would exclude the land value, I'm only depreciating $60,000, right? Over 27 and a half years. Mm-hmm. So there's a tax benefit, but it's not nearly as great as buying a higher price asset today. I'm not suggesting that somebody should go buy expensive real estate just to get this tax savings and ignore everything else, but there certainly is a piece there where even if you don't go cost seg with a higher priced property, that you'll benefit from that depreciation, even as a W-2 earner.
For sure. Yeah. So I think that that's been like really another reason why people are getting into the space, but yeah, it's certainly, you can't have everything.
Right, right.
You know, like you can't have it being completely hands off from the setup and then making you a ton of money every single month, but you're not doing anything. Like just like in any real estate investment, like the more work that you're willing to do on yourself, the higher your margin is. Sure. The less that you're willing to do on yourself, the lower your margin.
Right.
So you have to really decide what makes sense. Back to like the Airbnb stuff, something else that like you just kind of reminded me of in talking about with that is like you really have to decide like what your goal is, because I've had a ton of people that are like, oh, like, you know, I gotta get a good deal. And that's like their primary driver, is feeling like they have to get a good deal. But a good deal might not be a great short-term rental. And so I have other people that are like, I have to make a bunch of cash flow. And like for them, or like cash on cash return, it's like buy something that's completely renovated, put as little money down as you possibly can, get as many beds as you can, and like just spend all of your money, time on design and amenities. Where someone else who's like, I need to get a good deal, well, then get a good deal, but don't maybe expect the highest level of cash flow, because that good deal might be in Aurora and nobody wants to stay there.
Well, that's it. Maybe going back to the components of the differences between long-term and short-term rentals is that when I was buying heavy, it was in the hood because that's where the cash flow was. Well, guess what? I don't know anybody who wants to stay in Montbello in an Airbnb, not just because of the neighborhood, but you're not close to anything, right? Mm-hmm. High cash flow, long-term rentals are generally in, you know, relatively blue collar, lower income areas. And then when you get to something that's more desirable, whether it's Old Town Arvada or Broomfield or something like that, now you're going to increase your nightly rate, but also your value of the real estate goes up significantly. And so to your point, a good deal is different to everyone. Mm-hmm. For somebody who could get into a subject to deal with no money down and make $1,000 a month or 500,
right,
they're like high-fiving themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Because, oh, my cash on cash is infinite here. And they're proud of that. But the other person might have put $100,000 down, they're making $1,000 a month. And what's a better deal? I mean, it just depends on your lifestyle, your ability, and your resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's really important to figure out like what you're looking for. And I think that like sometimes people get so stuck on a property accomplishing everything, like a subject to deal that, you know, they're getting at like a low price that they're renovating and like they're doing as a short-term rental. I for real have people who are looking for all of those things. And it's like you end up not getting any of those things at a great rate. Like you're just getting like a mediocre property that's like not performing well, but like, sure, you got it sub two.
For sure.
Cool. Any parting wisdom? Like, what do you think that people should be focused on when they're thinking about building wealth long term through real estate?
Yeah. I think about this a lot, and I thought about a lot more when I was younger before I kind of had the plan. So I think in some ways it's a plan, right? For me, early on, it was all about acquisition, finding the best deal properties, the best cash flow, like the best way to acquire a property with little or no money down. And that led to buying in neighborhoods that weren't as great. But oftentimes lower price property appreciates faster, right? Because there's just the dollars equal more percentage. At some point, I shifted that mindset to how do I grow my net worth the fastest? Mm-hmm. And so that was through maybe doing development projects and things where I could take a big chunk of cash and 12 to 24 months later, I could effectively double that, pay the taxes, and then wash, rinse, and repeat. And so the development deals for me historically have been relatively passive with the right people in place. So I'm still able to do the loan business, generate an income there, but then get these pops every other year of these new construction projects. So that was a great way to grow net worth. And you mentioned the comment earlier about being cheap. And you know very well that you know we live well below our means because we invest most of our free cash flow. Then at some point, I shifted my mindset again to cash flow. And so at some point, it grew the net worth to a certain point where it's like, while this is great and the banks like it, it's really hard to pay for daycare with equity and properties, right?
Yeah.
And so the cash flow became more important. And I'd say that's where we shifted a little bit more, even most recently. My wife has the salon businesses. I have the money that I make from being a lender. We have the cash flow from the rental properties. And then I'm placing money in smaller, I would call them syndications, but private syndications on like a development deal or doing my own development deals because mm-hmm. those will create more money along the way. Now they come in pops, but if you don't need the money today and you can get it a year from now, then there's a good opportunity there, maybe a little private lending or things like that. So I think ultimately early on, someone's going to chase highest cash on cash return to your point. Understanding that the buyers of Airbnb and or long-term real estate, you have young people all the way to older people. I mean, I know a lot of older people that always thought about buying a duplex, but never did, right? And I think it was T. Harv Eker in the book, he says, don't wait to buy real estate and wait. I think that's true for long-term and for short-term. If you believe in Denver or Boulder or Broomfield or Arvada long-term versus Kansas City or Des Moines, Iowa or something like that, if you believe in this market and the people and the recreation, all of that, just own something here. Just simply own it. Now, don't put every last dollar. Have some reserves. Don't be afraid to partner with somebody. Find these opportunities. I think back to the first rental property that my wife and I bought, girlfriend at the time, was a 3-unit in Aurora. I bought it on a 203K loan, FHA. Bought it for 160, put about 35 into it, did all the work myself. I lived there for the time to meet the requirements of, you know, the 1 year for the FHA. And then I moved out and I still own that building today. Never did a refinance or anything. We owe like 110 on it. And one recently sold for 950. Now, that's great for the balance sheet from a net worth perspective, and it cash flows really well. But a lot of people would have refinanced multiple times, maybe eaten up the cash flow, use that money to do something else. Ultimately, you have to have a plan. And that's what it comes down to is, are you seeking cash flow? Are you seeking net worth? What are you doing to get from point A to point B? And there's this myth goal in the world of like, quit my job, right? And like, if you're making decent income at 25, 35, 45, like the idea of quitting your job to get your money from passive income without have bought it the property 10 or 15 years previous, like that's just not real, right? And so a plan, maybe you identify the cash flow number you need, and maybe it's the equity or net worth number that you need that's going to get you to a comfortable place. I know a guy who's teaching right now where buy some investment properties today, wait 10 years, sell the investment property, and just pay off your house, right? I mean, it's interesting because it's not what most people think of, but as I alluded to previously, I'm helping my dad sell this property so that he can park the money in a fund and not have to think about tenants and toilets and vacancies and rehabs. And you're going to get to a point where your money is making you money, right? And it's sometimes hard to see that early on, especially when you're running in the groups like you are, where people are, I've got 7 Airbnbs, you know, I'm making $200,000 a year. Pretty quickly, it's easy to feel like you fell behind, but everybody's path is different and everybody's path to success and how they measure success is significantly different too.
I think that that is really important. And like the people who are making that much money in Airbnb, there's a little secret that they have. They're also making a lot of money elsewhere.
For sure.
You know, like I know very few people, and like the people that I do know that are making like a lot of money in Airbnb that haven't been making like a bunch of money elsewhere, they're hustling their faces off, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. trying to get like other people to partner with them. And so you got to work, like
for sure.
You still got to keep your active income to be able to really make that passive income. And I think that it is a journey. And I think that if you're like feeling intimidated because, you know, everybody you're talking to is making $200,000 on their Airbnb portfolio, yes, that is like very possible. That's what I'm doing on my portfolio. But you and I both know that like I make a lot of money as a realtor. Like, that's the secret.
Yeah. I think my takeaway from our conversation here and what we talked about before we started recording was that your business has evolved in a place where you have literally the house hacker on the bottom, if you will, who's trying to get their first property and offset their income, all the way up to the multi-million dollar legacy or ski property buyer who they just want to offset their costs or know that it's the property is going to be vacant 9 months a year. It's not vacant. There's somebody there and it's being managed. And so what a beautiful thing for your business to be able to work with all these people and the people who level up from their first properties to maybe another more experienced property to a luxury property. Mm-hmm. And what's curious to me is like anybody can get started, right? It could be arbitrage or it could be buying a $2 million asset that you were going to visit for Christmas every year. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. And people are doing it in such different ways. Last thing. So for people who might be interested in like being a really passive investor, like maybe this episode, they're like, man, I'm like Travis. For those people, like I know of like a couple of like funds for short-term rentals. And so if you're interested in that, I'm happy to connect to you with short-term rental funds if you just love this space. Can people lend for hard money? Like, is that something that your company is taking on?
Yeah, not
like
through,
partnering on flips?
Yeah, good question. Not through the company I'm with now. It's all institutional money. But somebody who has a chunk, I would say minimum 50 and anything up from that number, there are ample opportunities to be a private money lender on a fix and flip, or even to somebody who's trying to get their Airbnb set up, where if you want to get creative, maybe you lend some money and take a note for the startup costs, and maybe you're getting paid out through the Airbnb payouts. I mean, you'd measure your risk accordingly, but I think that the true passive, make a loan, cash your check, or since the rental property thing doesn't work great right now, there are ample opportunities, a lot of diligence to do, because even the best operators can get into a pinch. I think funds are the best for the less, I don't want to say sophisticated, because you can be plenty sophisticated, but again, how much work do you want to do? If you want to go get 25% return on your money by making little loans to people who just need to get a property across the finish line, you'll do really well with that. You'll have to work your tail off and you'll probably be chasing to collect versus parking $500,000 in a fund, Airbnb fund, hard money fund, or whatever it is, where those that check's going to come every month and your rate of return won't be as strong, but you're also not talking about where the nearest Chinese restaurant is, right? So there's there's just a huge scale of active versus passive and what passive actually means.
Mm-hmm. And then in what states do you lend in? So obviously, like you do a ton of hard money here in Colorado. And so people that are doing like Airbnb or flips to like, you know, inject cash into their next investment, you're here in Colorado. Where else are you?
I'd say almost every major market. So I do the business in Colorado, but our company Renovo is in all every major market from Chicago down the whole East Coast, Texas, California, Arizona, Pacific Northwest. Like we pretty much cover it all. So if there's a listener out there that's looking to, maybe they're already a flipper, they do Airbnb on the side or vice versa, and they want to get into this business, our business is best suited for people who have some experience. Although we can measure experience by buying a house, doing a full rehab to make it an Airbnb. Like it doesn't have to be a quote unquote fix and flip, but happy to help if somebody wanted to reach out and I can make that connection. And honestly, like to be a resource for people in the space. I mean, you may have heard something I said today that you said, gosh, I want to do Airbnb, but I had this other question, or maybe the hell with him, I'm going to do Airbnb, you know, regardless. But, you know, we've been friends for a while. And if your listenership, you know, has a specific question, I can point them in the right direction. I'd be happy to do that too.
Yeah. I feel like I'm always asking you like random things because you've done so much. And I think that you're someone who has been consistent, like on the investment journey. And like, I think so many people dream of being in the position where they have like 14 rentals. And I think that like you're constantly challenging me on like, why are you doing this? Is this like a good use of your time? Yeah. Is this like a good use of your money? Like, here are all the different things that you can do. Like, does this make sense for you? And I think that that's like, it's a really valuable thing. Where can people find you if they have a question?
Sure. I'd probably email is probably best. And it's just Travis, T-R-A-V-I-S at Renovo, R-E-N-O-V-O financial.com.
And so I'll
Travis
put that in the notes.
At renovofinancial.com. Yep.
Awesome. Well, cool. Thanks so much,
Thank
Travis.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
All right, you guys. We'll see you next time.
As always, thanks so much for listening. If you like this episode, please share it with a friend who's also interested in real estate investing. And don't forget to subscribe and give us a review wherever you listen or watch your podcasts.